Available now, She Says, a new investigative podcast about sexual assault from WFAE. Listen to the first episode of She Says on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and WFAE.org/She Says.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It was 50 years ago Wednesday that spokesman Frank Mankiewicz told the world that Senator Robert F. Kennedy had died from an assassin's bullet.
Senator Robert Francis Kennedy died at 1:44 a.m. today, June 6, 1968. With Senator Kennedy, at the time of his death, were his wife, Ethel, his sisters, Mrs. Stephen Smith, Mrs. Patricia Lawford, brother-in-law, Mr. Stephen Smith, his sister-in-law, Mrs. John F. Kennedy. He was 42 years old.
Robert Kennedy was shot the night before after he had just won the 1968 California Democratic primary. For many who lived through that time, it seemed as though the world had stopped. RFK's assassination had come on the heels of Reverend Martin Luther King's murder. It was a double blow for many reasons, not the least of which was what the two had in common. Kennedy had attempted to quell the violence that followed King's assassination just 2 months before. He had worked to heal racial strife. He was fighting to decrease poverty. And he was challenging a sitting president from his own party as he pushed to end the war in Vietnam. Most of us go through stages in life. We change. Robert Kennedy certainly did. He may have ended life a liberal icon, but he began his political career as a staunch anti-communist who worked closely with now-discredited Wisconsin Senator Joseph McCarthy. It was, for its time, an extraordinary transformation, one that is chronicled in Larry Tye's book, Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. And Larry Tye joins us for the hour. Welcome to the program.
Great to be with you.
A tragic event like a murder always has an impact, one of which would be people wanting to see the positives in a person not wishing to speak ill of the dead, I suppose. Is that why we have forgotten Robert Kennedy's beginnings and his early political philosophy, or is it because he had genuinely changed and was moving in a different direction?
It's for both of those reasons, and because the Kennedy myth-making machine wanted us to forget that early Joe McCarthy days, which are something much of his family isn't proud of and that didn't quite fit with the take that we ended up with on Robert Kennedy in 1968.
When you say myth-making machine, is there really a I'm not sure the word to use here. Is there really a machine within the Kennedy family that works to burnish the images of the family members?
So it's not something that is self-aware enough to call it, I think, a myth-making machine, but it is the story of Bobby Kennedy that his children tell, that all of his staff and friends who are still around tell, and it's an understandable one. It has a way of explaining that early Joe McCarthy period as an asterisk or a footnote that didn't matter. And thankfully, the biggest truth teller and the one who knew Bobby Kennedy the best, his widow Ethel, is still around and 50 years later talks about the fact that Joe McCarthy wasn't an afterthought, that he was an important part of who Bobby was in those early days. And as she puts it, Joe McCarthy might have been a monster to much of the rest of America, or at least is today, but to the Kennedys, he was the guy who came over and played with their toddler, their firstborn Kathleen. He was a friend of the families, and while Bobby separated from him politically, he remained loyal to him, loyal enough for the rest of John McCarthy's life, that while brother Jack said, stay away from McCarthy's funeral in 1957, Bobby Kennedy showed up there.
We are the product of our upbringing and our parentage, I suppose. And you point out in the preface of your book that RFK was raised on the, this is a quote, rightist orthodoxies of his dynasty-building father and started his public life as counsel to the left-baiting, table-thumping Senator Joseph McCarthy. He also fought hard and got down in the dirt to help his brother become the president and as attorney general for John F. Kennedy. He okayed FBI wiretaps on Martin Luther King, who you say he never trusted or even liked. So how did this shift in outlook toward fighting some of the same battles that King fought and moving further to the left begin for Robert Kennedy? What triggered this shift?
So it was something that didn't happen with a single moment. During his entire life, Bobby Kennedy was growing by learning from experience. And in the case of civil rights and Martin Luther King, at the beginning of the Kennedy presidency, Bobby was pretty clueless when it came to issues of civil rights. He had grown up in two of the whitest places on the American continent, in Hyannisport, Massachusetts on Cape Cod, and in Palm Beach, Florida. And he didn't really have a basis of experience to understand the civil rights struggle. So in the early days, he was telling the Freedom Riders and the civil rights movement generally to slow down, not to embarrass his brother Jack, that the more important things going on in the Kennedy presidency were happening with an attempt to communicate with Khrushchev and the Soviet Union, and that we didn't want to be embarrassed in those talks by having bad things happen on the civil rights front in America. And there was one person in the civil rights movement in those days who, despite Bobby Kennedy's slow start, understood, as he put it, that there is good deep within Bobby Kennedy, and it is up to us to pull him out of that. And that person was Martin Luther King Jr.
Because of his close connection, or the connections that people made to him from the lower and middle classes to Bobby Kennedy and to his brother John, we sometimes forget that these guys were incredibly rich. He was raised, always chauffeur-driven around. I think you write that when he was a senator from New York, his staff had to teach him how to ride the subway. He didn't know the difference between a local and an express train because he'd always been driven around. So how could he possibly really understand the plight of the poor and the plight of African Americans in this country when he didn't really come into contact with them until later in life? Is that a fair assessment?
It is a fair assessment, and yet the extraordinary thing is that would be the end of the story for most politicians. For Bobby Kennedy, he learned. He learned by making mistakes. In the famous Freedom Rider bus burning in Anniston, Alabama, and later the riots in Birmingham and Montgomery, Bobby Kennedy got it wrong. He thought that the federal government could stay out of it. They came in much too late, and people suffered because of that. But he learned enough there that a year later in Mississippi at Ole Miss, when there were again all these threatened riots, Bobby Kennedy came in early and with force and in a way that saved people from being hurt. And that was what he did perpetually throughout his life. He learned about the plight of African Americans and the plight of people starving in America by visiting in the Mississippi Delta incredibly poor families, by getting down on the floor in his business suit to try to communicate with a starving toddler with a distended stomach. These are the kinds of things that U.S. senators didn't do, that politicians didn't do, and that today, if you looked at the change, people would dismiss it as a flip-flop. I think it was sincere, it was building during a lifetime, and it gave me faith in the redemptive power of politicians. Mm.
You write about a lot of things that I was too young to understand at the time or even remember, and that was his job as Attorney General and some of the things he did against organized crime and with Jimmy Hoffa and people like that, and his role as a kind of assistant president to his brother, John. I didn't really understand all that at the time. But the things that I remember about Robert Kennedy is exactly what you're talking about, going to poor people's homes, literally shacks, and getting down on the floor with young people and being very troubled and very riled up about poverty and conditions in America at the time. And both he and Martin Luther King came along at this time of great social upheaval. King certainly was part of he pricked the consciousness of America. Was Robert Kennedy at the tip of that spear as well, or was he merely riding the wave?
So he was always ahead of the wave. He was, on the one hand, started out as Attorney General as maybe the least prepared person who had ever been named to the office. Jack Kennedy joked that the giving Bobby the title of Attorney General was to give him some legal experience. He had never tried a case in a court of law. The truth is, Jack named Bobby Attorney General because Joe, Papa Joe, their father, told him to. He said partly that Bobby had earned it by running Jack's successful campaign in 1960, but more importantly, Jack was worried that Bobby needed somebody in the cabinet to protect his back, to watch out for him substantively and politically, and Bobby did that. He did it on issues exactly like the ones you described, in everything from waging a war against organized crime to eventually becoming a great advocate for civil rights. And those are things you expected an attorney general to do. He did it during the Cuban Missile Crisis by being Jack's most trusted confidant at the most heated moment in his presidency. He was the closest thing America has ever seen and then will ever see to a co-presidency.
Larry Tye is the author of Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. It's one of many books about Bobby Kennedy that exists, but this one comes highly praised from some significant people, and for reasons that we'll talk about when we come back, including the fact that he got a lot of people to talk about Bobby Kennedy who have never done so on the record, including Ethel Kennedy. We'll come back with more in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Larry Tye today. He is the author of Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. Robert Kennedy lost his life 50 years ago on Wednesday of this week. Roger Mudd, formerly with CBS and NBC News, and a man who knew Robert Kennedy, says that your book is the definitive biography of one of America's most compelling political figures. Definitive biography. How did you accomplish this? What was your process? Because as you mentioned before we went on the air, there are a lot of other biographies of Robert Kennedy.
So I'm not sure what definitive means, but what I did was interviewed probably 400, 450 people, including Roger Mudd. And I think that a lot of people, I'd like to tell you that I was incredibly convincing or charismatic, and that's why people like Ethel talked to me. I think the truth is more likely that she was getting old, she just turned 90, and that she looked around and decided it was me or nobody. And if you get to people at that point in their lives where they don't want to go to their graves with their stories untold, and you're willing to be persistent the way any journalist is, people will eventually talk. And I think that I was lucky to get lots of people to talk for whom I was their last interview, from George McGovern, who died shortly afterwards, to Nick Katzenbach, who succeeded Bobby as Attorney General. And I want to say that Bobby Kennedy, I know you're in the middle of a fund drive there, that Bobby Kennedy believed in good journalism. And my guess is if he were around today, he'd be calling up and donating money, because he understood that, and especially in an era like this era of Trump, that good journalism and factual journalism really does matter.
Talk to me about Ethel Kennedy. How much time did you get to spend with her?
So it was classic Kennedy. I tried Ethel perpetually. I either heard nothing or I would hear from her aide she wasn't interested. And then just after I had given up, I get an email saying, "Do you want to talk to Ethel?" And I thought it was great. And I happened to be writing from a place that's about 10 miles from where the Kennedys live in Hyannisport. But it would have been too easy to say, just drive over and we'll talk. I had to fly from Cape Cod to Palm Beach to talk to her. And I ended up doing that twice for about 2 hours each time. Mm-hmm. The first time was wonderful, and I had front-loaded all my questions. I assumed, I knew she didn't like journalists, she liked authors even less, and that she was going to kick me out after 15 minutes. So I would ask her everything that I needed in the first 15 minutes. At the end of 2 hours, I had run out of questions, and by that point, she was there in her bare feet, walking me out the door, asking whether I wanted her to make me a lunch and take me to the airport. I knew what kind of a cook she was, I knew what kind of a driver she was, so I thanked her and left, but she was extraordinary. She answered questions that, whether it was the relationship that Bobby had had with Joe McCarthy, to what it meant to her to be left with 10 kids and an 11th on the way when Bobby died. And she answered them with a candor that suggested after 50 years, she didn't need to spin anybody. She didn't need to tell any myth-making versions of stories. She was incredibly honest. And as I mentioned before, she was honest about the close relationship the Kennedys had with Joe McCarthy. But I also asked her whether she had ever considered, when Bobby died, Ethel was named by Gallup and all the other pollsters as the most popular woman in America, having displaced Jackie. And I asked, did you ever think about getting remarried? There were lots of people who were courting her in those days, famous people like Andy Williams, the singer. And she pointed to her wedding ring, and then she pointed up in the air, and she said, how could I even consider getting remarried? I'm still married to Bobby.
She still wears her ring.
She still wears her ring. Had it been a politician who was saying that to me, I would say I was getting a spun version of the story. Ethel's a woman of deep faith and huge commitment to her husband, and they were alter egos, and she believes it.
What do you think her perspective, after all these years of not talking to people about her husband and about that time in her life, what do you think her perspective on her late husband brings to our understanding of the man and our understanding of Bobby Kennedy, the politician?
So it humanizes him. It says that he was an iconic figure, but not a perfect figure, and she was willing to talk about his flaws as well as all the great legacy that he left us. But she also talked about things that only somebody as close as Ethel could understand. She said that Bobby's relationship with Jack was one, the cliche is they would finish one another's sentences. She said they didn't even have to do that. They just looked at one another, and whatever the issue was, they instinctually got with the first couple words where the other one was going with it. And it was the kind of relationship of brothers and of political figures that, again, I hate to use the word unique, but it was really unusual. And I can say unique because after they had that relationship, Congress passed what was called the No Nepotism Law, and that's the law that prevented Donald Trump from appointing his daughter or son-in-law to senior positions, and that law is known still today on Capitol Hill as the Bobby Kennedy Law. Despite Bobby's having been what may have been, I think, the greatest attorney general, the least prepared when he went in and when he went out, the greatest attorney general in modern American history, the lesson Congress took away is we don't want siblings or other people that close in positions of power.
Why the animosity between RFK and LBJ? When Lyndon Johnson took over for John Kennedy, he kind of shut out Bobby Kennedy. The phone calls to the Attorney General's office from the White House stopped.
So there were four people in Bobby's life that he truly detested. And with the first three, I think he had pretty good judgment. One was J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI director. Another was Jimmy Hoffa, the powerful and corrupt head of the Teamsters Union. A third one was Roy Cohn, Joe McCarthy's protege and Donald Trump's tutor. But the fourth one was Lyndon Johnson. And that was one that was tragic. I think that what it was is Johnson came from East Texas Community College and from growing up in relative poverty. Bobby Kennedy came from Harvard University and growing up with endless wealth. Their universes were such that they couldn't relate to one another. Bobby saw LBJ as a liar and an embellisher. LBJ saw Bobby as a pissant kid who got the job only because his brother was the president. And Bobby used, during those 3 years of the Kennedy administration, every chance he got to put down Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson never forgot those slights, not one of them. And when he became president, from day one, Bobby was told in symbolic and concrete ways that essentially he was out and he could stay for as long as he wanted within a grace period, but that his access to power was gone.
Wow. You talked, I understand, to about 400 people over the course of doing research for this book, and I'm certain, maybe I'm wrong, but I'm certain that there are some points of view that you heard from these different people about Robert Kennedy that may not be in agreement. How do you, as a biographer of sorts, sort those out? How do you discern which is the truest account of the man or his actions versus something you'd like? Because I know you're a fan of Robert Kennedy, versus something you'd like to be true.
So what you do is you talk to as many people with as many different takes. You go back and look at original and secondary sources as much as you can. When you hear from Jimmy Hoffa Jr. that at night, at home, his dad, Jimmy Hoffa, the head of the Teamsters, would come home with hateful stories about Bobby Kennedy, it gives you a different take that Bobby goes in this battle with Jimmy Hoffa and assumes that he's on the side of right and he's taking on a corrupt union leader. Jimmy Hoffa would come home at night and tell stories about this attorney general who had a vendetta against him and didn't understand why the million members of the Teamsters kept reelecting him. And the more Bobby would attack, the more the Teamsters would rally behind their leader. So partly you're understanding that people naturally have different takes depending on where they're coming from, and you're trying to piece those together. But what you're also doing, and this is maybe the most important thing, is you're listening to as many original sources as possible. So on the Cuba Missile Crisis, one of the critical moments in American history and in Kennedy family history, you read Bobby Kennedy's, at the time, seemingly definitive version called 13 Days, where he was the hero calling for this middle ground of a blockade, talking down the generals, talking up his brother's viewpoint. You read that and you find that convincing until you listen to the tapes, the original tapes of what was actually going on in the cabinet room during those meetings. And for the first 6 or 7 of those 13 days, Bobby Kennedy was right there with the generals calling for an air attack on Cuba and calling for precisely the kind of thing that he denied in his own book. And he could get away with the denial because the tapes weren't made public at that point and he thought they never would be. But you try to piece together what the truth is and what somebody's spin in later years is. And Bobby Kennedy, while he really was an iconic figure, was also one of the great political spinmeisters of all time.
You had access to those tapes that many people have not had access to. You had access to reams of papers that no one has had access to. How did that come about?
So the tapes were actually out there, and they were public years before I started writing. But the other material, what initially sparked my interest and my publisher's interest in the book was the fact that the Kennedy family, after 40-something years of not allowing the last of Bobby's papers to become public, decided to make them public just as I was thinking about the book. And so it was just chance that I was the first one to get a look at those. With other things, with people's memoirs, I tried to understand, as we're here on the 50th anniversary of Bobby's assassination, what happened and why he had so little police protection in Los Angeles that night and all day campaigning there. And the unpublished memoir of the chief of police helped me understand why the police weren't there in greater force, which is that Bobby didn't want them to be and that he didn't get along with the mayor of Los Angeles. And that may have been one of the reasons why he didn't have the protection he ought to have had. But all of those things, people years later are willing to open up things because they were just sitting there, the unpublished memoirs, the various Kennedy documents, other things.
Robbie Kennedy really went after Jimmy Hoffa. And this is interesting to me because the Democratic Party and unions are closely aligned. Why? Was it just a simple difference in the political times? Why did he go after a union which supported the Democratic Party?
So he went after the Teamsters because he was working at the time. This is when Joe McCarthy lost the chairmanship of that famous permanent subcommittee on investigations, and an Arkansas senator named John McClellan took it over. And Bobby was his chief aide, and they decided collaboratively to look at both unions and management. And Bobby Kennedy decided, and I think this was a moment of valor on his part, that he decided that the Teamsters were being done a disservice by the corruption that he was uncovering by their president, Jimmy Hoffa, and by his predecessor, a guy named Dave Beck. And Bobby decided that whatever the implications were for his brother, who wanted to be president and was counting on unions to support him, that he was going to go after this corruption. And it ended up that the Teamsters became a very Republican union. They supported Richard Nixon. Jack Kennedy wasn't delighted with his brother's going after any Teamster, any unions, and certainly not the biggest union and the most powerful one in America, the Teamsters. But this was a matter of integrity to Bobby, and he followed up on that as Attorney General and continued going after many of his enemies, like Jimmy Hoffa and Roy Cohn.
As I mentioned, his father got him his father had a close relationship with Joseph McCarthy and got him the job with Joseph McCarthy. And Bobby Kennedy went on to do some of the most legally accurate work for Joseph McCarthy. But McCarthy was on a witch hunt, a communist witch hunt. When did Bobby leave McCarthy? Why did he leave? Did he ever feel the need to justify his ties to Joseph McCarthy?
So he was perpetually asked to justify his ties. And the truth is that Bobby Kennedy went to work for Joe McCarthy, not just because Joe Kennedy said to, but because Bobby Kennedy honestly believed back then that Joe McCarthy was the only one taking seriously the communist threat, not just in the Soviet Union, but behind every pillar in the State Department. Bobby Kennedy, like his father, was a cold warrior. He continued to believe in Joe McCarthy's mission. He left after 7.5 months, not because of any disagreement with McCarthy, but because he couldn't stomach his nominal boss, Roy Cohn, this brilliant and obnoxious young lawyer running McCarthy's staff. And Bobby Kennedy, for the rest of his life, continued to defend Joe McCarthy and blamed any excesses not on McCarthy, but on Roy Cohn. And that was letting McCarthy off the hook.
Larry Tye is the author of Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. We will continue our conversation in a moment and get into some of the other late life activities of Bobby Kennedy just prior to his assassination when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Larry Tye is our guest today. He's the biographer who wrote the book Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon, in which he talked to 400 people, many of whom had never spoken to anybody about Robert Kennedy, including Ethel Kennedy, about the man and the politician. Of course, the Kennedys were a dynasty in American politics. John Kennedy, the president, Robert Kennedy, the attorney general and presidential candidate and senator, and Senator Ted Kennedy. Were all three brothers cut from the same cloth? Did they all have the same ideals, the same goals, the same beliefs?
So actually, they were very different, all three of them. And to contrast Bobby Kennedy to Jack Kennedy, I'd like to tell a quick story. Joe Kennedy's dream, as we know, was for each of his boys, one after the other, to occupy the White House. Rose Kennedy, the matriarch, who died at 250 and was America's first lady, had a very different dream for her sons, and it was that one of them would make the Catholic Church their calling. Had John Kennedy gone into the church, he would have been the Pope, because that was the kind of guy he was. He was a bit of an elitist, an intellectual. He liked to be in charge. Had Bobby Kennedy gone to the church, he would have been a parish priest, because that was the way he learned. He learned at a grassroots level. He learned by experience, and he got better all the time. And I have a bias, and I would much rather have as my president a parish priest than I think the Pope. And I think that was what Bobby was all about. Ted Kennedy came along after the two iconic brothers, and I think Ted Kennedy, who was a great senator, who was one of my best sources during my 15 years at the Boston Globe, I think Ted Kennedy really found his place in the Senate, but I also think he spent his 50 years in the U.S. Senate trying to be Bobby.
Wow. The press at the time kept John Kennedy's sexual peccadilloes quiet. We know about them today. How much like his brother was Robert Kennedy in that department, and how much did he help enable his brother's extramarital liaisons?
So I think that's another way that Bobby was different from both brothers. I won't say that he didn't have extramarital affairs, but anything he had was quiet enough and was infrequent enough that Ethel, I think, learned to look the other way and forgive him and stay in love with him. I think Bobby never considered leaving his wife, I think he basically learned by having to pick up after Jack in terms of some of his affairs and keep them quiet, that whatever his instincts were, he learned to be more careful and be more restrained.
You mentioned before we went on the air that in the year following the death of his brother John, he was the nation's mourner-in-chief and then went into a deep depression for several months after that ended. Bobby Kennedy did not cooperate with the Warren Commission investigating the assassination of his brother. Why? And what did Bobby Kennedy believe happened on November 22nd, 1963?
So I think, and I don't have anything that I can point to as definitive evidence on this, I think what Bobby really thought was he worried that he had somehow stirred up a hornet's nest that had come back to sting his brother. I think that he worried that maybe his campaign against organized crime, maybe his war against Jimmy Hoffa, maybe his secret war for more than a year against Fidel Castro trying to displace his government and trying to assassinate Castro, that one of those, all three were the kinds of people that he was stirring up who could have come back and done something bad. Bobby always used to say to friends, it should have been me. And I think that's what he meant, that he was the one who had somehow done something that came back and ended up in his brother being killed. Bobby, to his deathbed, believed that the true story would never come out unless he was president and could lead, could appoint the investigators and oversee the investigation. And that's what he was waiting for, I think, to get the real answers.
So you're saying that it wasn't that he didn't want to know the truth or he didn't want the truth to get out. It was that he didn't think the Warren Commission would find the truth or that they would cover up the truth.
So I think that he always said publicly that he endorsed the findings of the Warren Commission. He said privately something quite different, and I think it was that he never trusted that any commission investigating under the authority of somebody he hated, Lyndon Johnson, would ever either have the incentive, the time, or the resources to get at the truth. Mm-hmm. The Warren Commission did its investigating quite quickly, and it gave Lyndon Johnson an answer that may or may not have been the right one, but it was one that let Johnson put everything behind him, and Bobby Kennedy wasn't so quick to be willing to put things behind him.
People who didn't live through those times cannot possibly, I don't think, understand what the country was going through and how the deaths of these three people, John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and Martin Luther King, impacted the country. Whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, a conservative or a liberal, it was a strike at the heart of America. And Robert Kennedy's death came 2 months almost to the day after Martin Luther King's death. It came 5 years after his brother's death. And the night of Dr. Martin Luther King's death, he was scheduled to go to a campaign rally in Indianapolis, which was racially divided. And he was able to speak to black people and white people using the same words and the same message and get through to both sectors. And the mayor of Indianapolis that night said he couldn't go into the black area of town because of the death of Martin Luther King. And he said, "You're not telling me where I can go and what I can say and what I can do." And he went. And he put himself into considerable danger, we're told, but he helped to calm the bill. He made the announcement that Martin Luther King had died and calmed them down. That was one of the few cities in the country where there was no racial violence. He had become, I think you say this, the most trusted white man in black America. But at one time, he had given the FBI permission to tap Martin Luther King. He wasn't a fan. Had his opinion on King changed?
Yes, so King's opinion on him was vindicated that night. We talked earlier that at the beginning of Bobby's time as Attorney General in the early 1960s, King was one of the only civil rights leaders who had faith that Bobby had good within him and that the movement could pull it out. He showed it that night in Indianapolis. He flies in the family plane, the Caroline, and lands in Indianapolis, greeted by Mayor Richard Lugar, who says to him, "You will not go in and give your speech that you plan to give tonight in the middle of the ghetto. You won't go in because you might not come out alive and you will cause a riot." Bobby ignores that advice. He jumps. He goes into the black ghetto in Indianapolis, jumps on the back of a flatbed pickup truck, and takes all the notes that his young aides have prepared for him on what to say that night, crumples them up and throws them away, and for the next 5 minutes delivers what might have been the most pitch-perfect speech a white politician or any politician had ever given to a black audience or any audience. He talked for the first time in the 5 years since Jack had died about his brother's death. He still couldn't bring himself to call that night his brother Jack or even say my brother. He talked about having lost a member of his family. Mm-hmm. But something magical happened that night. He had gone in to embrace the black community of Indianapolis for the death of their beloved Martin Luther King, and instead the community embraced him for the loss of his brother Jack. That night, in the back of the crowd, signs went up that turned up every time that Bobby spoke to a black audience for the next 2 months, and the sign was quite modest. It said, "White, but all right." I think it's possible, if a journalist can ever say anything without any hyperbole, to say that Bobby really was, for the rest of his life, precisely the guy, the good guy, that Martin Luther King had had faith that he'd become, and that he was the most popular white man and certainly the most popular white politician in black America.
Kennedy saw Hubert Humphrey, the man who would ultimately get the nomination, as somebody who would continue the policies of Lyndon Johnson when it came to the war in Vietnam, and also that administration's policies toward cities. What did that mean, their policies toward cities?
So I think that their policy towards cities was, in most people's eye, one of the most enlightened and ambitious in terms of trying to redress poverty and racial injustice that had ever been there. But Bobby Kennedy thought we could do better. Mm. And he proved that we could do better by setting up a model program in the biggest ghetto in America, in Bedford-Stuyvesant in New York. And so Bobby Kennedy was running on a three-pronged program when he finally declared for presidency. He was running to try to end racial intolerance, trying to, as much as we could, end poverty, and sure as heck trying to get us out of Vietnam quicker than he felt either Richard Nixon or Hubert Humphrey would do.
You note that on the night of his assassination, his last words in public were, "Now it's on to Chicago and let's win there." And I had always assumed, and I think most people had always assumed, that he meant on to the Democratic National Convention that August in Chicago and a win there. You're saying that's not true. He was planning to go to Chicago and meet with Richard Daley to seek his endorsement so that he could win the nomination, because he was way behind Hubert Humphrey at that time.
So I think he had two meanings in mind when he said on to Chicago. One was clearly the public meaning, which is on to that summer's convention. But the private meeting was a private meeting that he had set up the next day with Richard Daley. And 50 years on, Daley's son, Bill Daley, Barack Obama's former chief of staff, says that there was an 80% chance that his dad was going to endorse Bobby the next day. Mm. Had he done that, the most powerful big city mayor in America and precisely the kind of politician that Humphrey was counting on to deliver to him the non-primary states, had he done that, I'm convinced it would have set off a wave among powerful Democratic politicians. And I believe, and I can't prove myself right, but nobody can prove me wrong, that the ticket in 1968 would have been Kennedy-Humphrey, that without the horrors of that violence at the Chicago Democratic Convention, that ticket would have gone up against Nixon-Agnew and would have beat them easily. Bobby Kennedy was, from 8 years before, the person in America who best understood, from running his brother Jack's successful campaign against Nixon, just what Nixon's vulnerabilities were. And it's not difficult to imagine what a different America we would have been then and today, yeah, had we had Bobby Kennedy as president instead of Richard Nixon.
What would he have changed had he become president? What would have happened, do you think?
So I think he was impatient enough. When Jack Kennedy was asked the tough questions, when are you going to give us a really strong civil rights bill? When are you going to get us out of Vietnam? His answer was always, when I'm reelected in 1964. Bobby Kennedy would have tried in the first 5 minutes in office to do those things and other important things. And I think that he understood he was a better senator than Jack, and he understood the mechanisms of how Washington worked better than anybody but Lyndon Johnson. I think we would have really gotten things done. We would have seen the Great Society programs of Johnson be getting a second act rather than being undermined in 1968 in the new presidency.
We have a minute left, and Bobby Kennedy's son Patrick has asked for an investigation to be opened into his father's death. He met for hours with his convicted killer, Sirhan Sirhan. Why do you believe he believes that we don't know the whole story, and do you think he's right?
So that was Bobby Jr., and he does believe, and so does Paul Schrade, this union leader, which is the one that Bobby Jr. was really listening to and who was also injured that night at the Ambassador Hotel. They believe we don't know the true story. I believe that most people who could give us a true story are long dead. And On Bobby's 50th of his assassination, we should be focusing, as most of his family and his wife believe, on Bobby's positive legacy rather than dredging up questions that we'll probably never answer about his assassination.
Larry Tye is the author of Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. I want to thank you for the hour.
It was great to be with you.